From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, September 10, 2008. On today's newscast, we'll hear about relief efforts in Haiti, where storm after storm has wreaked havoc. Parents in India organize and demonstrate against soaring child trafficking. And we'll hear how residents in the Southwest are talking about safe and alternative energy. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for that and more after this news.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. The Bush administration's planned barrier along the U.S.-Mexico border is falling far behind schedule and running $400 million over budget. Meanwhile, the so-called virtual fence, a high-tech monitoring system built by Boeing, has been put on hold. The multi-million dollar virtual fence project has been plagued by technical problems for several months. The White House is pushing to finish 670 miles of physical barriers along the southern border before President Bush leaves office. So far, only half of the fence has been completed. Iowa's attorney general has filed a slew of criminal charges against the owners and top managers of Agriprocessors Kosher Meatpacking Plant in Postville. In May, the plant was the site of one of the largest immigration raids in U.S. history. The plant's leadership now faces more than 9,000 misdemeanor charges stemming from alleged child labor violations. An official affidavit says that minors were made to work with dangerous meatpacking machinery that only adults can legally operate. All of the previous charges related to the Postville raid have exclusively targeted the detained workers. In other labor news, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers can now claim one more victory in their campaign for better wages and working conditions in Florida's tomato fields. Whole Foods Market signed an agreement yesterday in support of the farm worker group's penny per pound tomato program. Andalusia Knoll has more.
Building on past victories against fast food giants McDonald's, Burger King, and Taco Bell, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, or CIW, have taken their campaign against modern-day slavery in Florida's tomato fields to the supermarket. Whole Foods Market has become the first national supermarket chain to agree to pay one penny more per pound for Florida-grown tomatoes. This additional penny will be passed on directly to the farm workers, representing a significant increase in their long, stagnant salaries. Whole Foods currently has a written commitment to buy quality products from developing countries that, quote, provides more money to producers, ensures better wages and working conditions for workers, and cares for the environment. Whole Foods told the CIW they are exploring the possibility of expanding this guarantee to their domestic market. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers will continue to organize for better wages and working conditions by setting the sights of their Fair Food campaign on the Subway franchise. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andalusia Knoll.
In Bolivia, tensions between the national government and right-wing political leaders in the resource-rich eastern provinces have flared up again. Opposition groups in the provinces of Beni, Tarija, and Santa Cruz led violent protests yesterday and took over government offices and airports. Lenny Olivera has more from Cochabamba.
The protests were led by a group of businessmen and local politicians in Bolivia's gas-rich regions who objected to a government program that raised taxes on the natural gas industry in order to help fund a pension system for senior citizens. The right-wing demonstrations attacked and looted buildings, housing, the National Telecommunications Company, the National Institute of Agrarian Reform, and the National Taxation Service. They also blockaded roads and airports in Tarija and Beni. The national government says the opposition's actions are a provocation aimed at making President Evo Morales declare emergency rule. Members of Bolivia's powerful social movements began a blockade of the highway that connects the opposition-dominated province of Santa Cruz with Cochabamba, a province where support for the president runs high. Social movement leaders have also announced plans to march on foot from Oruro to La Paz to call on the Bolivian Congress to approve a nationwide referendum on a new constitution, something the opposition has tried to block. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lenny Olivera in Cochabamba, Bolivia.
U.S. Representative Denis Kucinich has announced a new phase of his mission to impeach President Bush and Vice President Cheney, a National Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Kucinich says the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's goal is to bring about accountability and to create a process for future presidents should he or she operate outside of the realm of the Constitution. FSRN caught up with the Ohio representative in the halls of Congress.
Tomorrow is going to be the seventh remembrance of 9/11. And yet the very government that took us into a war against Iraq and keeps us in war against Iraq has not been held accountable for the fact that they took us into a war based on lies. Impeachment has always been about accountability, and it remains about accountability.
Kucinich plans to offer this proposal to Congress before the end of the year. He has tried and failed to begin impeachment proceedings three times in the past 2 years. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Hurricane Ike took its toll in Haiti this weekend. The small nation has been ravaged by four brutal storms in as many weeks, leaving about 650,000 people stranded and claiming some 600 lives. Haiti has yet to recover from April's food riots, a result of demonstrations against rising basic food prices that turned violent, and women and children are some of the hardest hit. As aid workers attempt to make their way to help with relief efforts, they're finding that essential infrastructure, such as roads and bridges, have literally been washed away. Diana Duarte is the media coordinator for MADRE, an international human rights organization.
In natural disasters, wherever they occur across the globe, women often face a disproportionate impact, and this is definitely the case in Haiti. Women are overrepresented among the poor, and not only that, but women often are primarily responsible for caretaking of those who are already vulnerable. So that means children, the elderly, people who are ill, people who are disabled. So women, they bear much of the responsibility in responding to these storms, but they also have less of the resources to be able to do that, which is why it's so important for MADRE in particular, but for other organizations that are working in Haiti to support women and to recognize that women have to be central to any disaster relief effort.
MADRE has sent an emergency response team to Gonaïves, one of the cities on Haiti's coast that has felt the brunt of the storm, and they're partnered with two local sister organizations in Haiti, trusting that people on the ground know how to best make use of available resources.
The work that we're doing with them is we're working to collect donations for things like plastic sheeting and food aid, water jugs, water treatments that can prevent some of the waterborne illnesses, and other emergency relief. And what's important is that they are already on the ground in these areas that have been hard hit by these storms. They're already aware of who are the people who are most vulnerable in the community and how to best reach them in what may be some very chaotic flood conditions. Being members of the community, they would know if, you know, the house on this side of the hill has a new baby, so they need special attention, or if another house has somebody who is ill or elderly and can't walk and needs special attention. So by taking the money that we're able to collect from our members and from other people who donate to MADRE and funneling it towards these local organizations, we're able to deliver aid more quickly and also more effectively.
MADRE is collecting donations for their effort. More information at madre.org. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Thousands of people in India go missing every year without a trace. Activists believe a vast network of human traffickers operates in India, making the nation the source, destination, and transit country for men, women, and children trafficked for the purposes of forced labor and commercial sexual exploitation. Now, family members of missing children have begun organizing, and amidst worries that their children may have fallen prey to human traffickers, parents are on an indefinite sit-in in New Delhi. Bismila Jilani has the story.
Sixteen-year-old Munna spends most of his time outside a music shop in Delhi, listening and then singing Hindi songs. This is the place he was kidnapped from 6 years ago. A year later, his parents found him begging outside a temple in the neighboring state of Uttar Pradesh. Munna says his abductors chopped off his right hand and left foot and told him to beg and bring money. There are thousands others who went missing like Munna but weren't heard of ever again. Mahadev Muthia is among the protesters in New Delhi. He has been dragging himself from pillar to post in search of his three daughters and two sons who went missing from their home in Assam 8 months ago.
We had gone to attend a wedding, leaving our children at home. But when we came back, they were not there. I checked everywhere but couldn't find them. I sought help from my fellow villagers, but they couldn't do anything. Then I informed police, but that didn't help either. After some time, I went to the police station again to lodge another complaint. This time, the policeman said that my problem could be solved only in Delhi, so I came here.
Muthiah traveled 2,000 miles to Delhi to make his complaint heard nationally. Similar is the story of another parent, Manish Kumar Das. His teenage daughter and niece had come to Delhi 3 months ago to work as domestic help and weren't seen since.
The girls were offered jobs and brought to Delhi, but what happened to them afterwards, nobody knows. From Jharkhand in central India to Delhi, I have searched everywhere but couldn't trace them. Now some people say they may have been sold to brothels, and that worries me to no end. The police assured us that they will find them, but they did nothing.
Human trafficking has been afflicting India for decades now. According to the National Crime Records Bureau, nearly 45,000 people go missing every year in the country, more than 11,000 of them without any trace. A large number among these are children below 12 years. Social activist Devi Singh Suryavanshi puts the number much higher.
Children and adults alike are being trafficked and sold. Young boys then end up being bonded laborers, while the girls are thrown into prostitution. Union Minister for Family Affairs Renuka Chaudhry herself has acknowledged that 44,000 people are trafficked every year. The figure is actually 100,000, and I have evidence to prove that. The difference is because in many cases the police do not even register the complaints.
Ravi Kant is the secretary of Shakti Vahini, a New Delhi-based NGO campaigning against human trafficking. He says the traffickers have a well-organized network operating across the country.
Trafficking is a well-organized crime and has spread throughout the country, with Delhi the transit point, not only for India. The girls are trafficked from Nepal, Bangladesh, East European countries, Thailand, and other places as well. And Delhi is the transit for all.
But police authorities disagree. Alok Verma is public relations officer in Delhi police.
There isn't yet any evidence that the kidnappings are organized. Whether for the purpose of begging, prostitution, or any other crime. We do, however, receive many complaints about missing people, mostly from people who come to Delhi from other places.
Well, there may be differences over the existence or non-existence of a network of traffickers in India. The undisputed fact remains that every year, thousands of people in the country vanish without any trace. Where do they go? The authorities offer no answers. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
Residents of Nevada and Utah are waiting for the Bureau of Land Management to release a report for a proposed coal-fired power plant. As John Pike reports, the controversy over this plant has highlighted the debate on safe and alternative energy in the Southwest.
Eastern Nevada, near the Utah border, is the high desert. Joshua trees and brush are interspersed between the rocks and sand. Rocky hills dot the horizon here, and signs of humanity are few and far between. This is where Sith Global Power wants to build a 750-megawatt coal-fired power plant. Under an earlier proposal, the plant was to have used natural gas. But that changed when gas prices started going up. Seth says the plant is needed to keep up with power demands for a growing part of the country. A number of Nevadans and Utahns say they are concerned about coal pollution, especially mercury emissions in the coal smoke. The mayors of Mesquite, Nevada, St. George, Utah, and Springdale, Utah, all of which are within an easy drive of each other and the proposed power plant, have all publicly registered their opposition to the plant. Mayor Susan Holacek of Mesquite says she sees the plant bringing no benefit to her town.
With the proposed coal-fired plant being only 12 miles from Mesquite, the fact was is that we were not going to receive any of the benefits, for instance, taxes, anything that could benefit this community, but we would get the adverse effects from the plant, that being health considerations.
She also says that people come to Mesquite for the clean air and desert scenery, which she says would be marred by coal pollution. The plant has to pass environmental muster with Nevada state and federal authorities. The Bureau of Land Management is involved because the plant requires an access road and a railway spur on federal land to operate. The Bureau first put a date of April on a release of its draft environmental impact statement, but the Bureau says one factor that's pushed the release date to September is the amount of public comments they've received on the project. One member of the public who has made his opinion known at public meetings is Max Gregorick, a business owner in Springdale, Utah. He says that business people like him in Springdale, which is right by Zion National Park, are united against this plant because they're dependent on the environment for their livelihood.
I think that from most of the people I've talked to, they're really mostly concerned about the air quality and the fact that, this will directly affect Zion National Park's spectacular viewshed. A lot of the locals here make their money on tourism.
People in St. George, Utah, near Springdale, are registering their opposition, too. Dr. Craig Booth, a physician from St. George, who says he has been concerned about the health effects of coal-fired power plants for several years, says in his experience, the owners of coal-fired power plants can't be trusted.
They're not concerned with who they pollute. They're not concerned with the economic impact, positive or negative. They are out to make a buck.
Booth says he has yet to see anything from Sith that shows otherwise. But Sith Global Power says they're concerned about pollution also. A spokesperson for the project, Frank Mezzano, says one of the best ways to reduce coal power plant pollution is to replace older power plants with newer, cleaner plants that can significantly reduce pollution. However, national environmental organizations, such as the Sierra Club, question the viability of coal as part of the country's energy future. A 2007 report by the Sierra Club says the country needs to look to cleaner alternatives, quote, rather than locking ourselves into using a polluting backward technology for the next 50 years that harms people, damages our environment, and makes global warming much worse. Opponents and proponents of the plant are also waiting on the state of Nevada to issue its report on this plant's air quality issues, which could be built and working by 2013. John Pike, Free Speech Radio News, St. George, Utah.
You're listening to FSRN. Coming up next, Leanne Caldwell speaks with FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein about the transition to digital TV. Stay with us. A 50-city tour kicks off today in Oakland, organized by the Federal Communications Commission on the transition to digital TV. The FCC is conducting a massive outreach effort to tell people that on February 17, as many as 19 million people who don't have cable or satellite will need a digital converter box for their television to work. Wilmington, North Carolina was the pilot city where residents underwent the switch Monday. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell spoke with Jonathan Adelstein, commissioner on the Federal Communications Commission, about those who are left out of the digital transition.
We're very concerned about those vulnerable populations, such as people with low incomes, members of various new immigrant groups, or some minorities, that people that have disabilities, that they might not be able to really get the message because they need to have it tailored to meet whatever concerns they have. Now, we've made a special effort to reach out to them, but I'm not sure it's enough. And frankly, a lot of people, for example, those with disabilities that may not be able to hook up the television set without assistance, we don't have a program in place to help them, frankly. The government hasn't done that. In other countries, the government has a program of technical assistance to people who need special help. And frankly, in this country, we don't have that. And I'm not sure we're doing everything we need to do to get in a position of being able to help those people. We're really going to rely to a large extent on the private sector, volunteers, community groups, churches, synagogues, and mosques to get help to those members of the congregation who need them. But some people who aren't necessarily being touched by those community groups, we're very worried about. That's who we're most concerned with.
And there's no plans to implement some sort of government-run program?
There isn't. There's no funding for it. There's no mechanism for it. And I'm not sure that's the best way to accomplish this transition, but that's the reality that we face. I mean, I'm not happy about the lack of a technical assistance plan. Some in Congress are talking about it, but at this late stage, it doesn't look like we're going to have that. So we really need to have help from community organizations, community leaders, volunteers, people who are somewhat technically savvy. I mean, this isn't that complicated for most people, but for some people who are just averse to technology or have special disabilities, it's going to be more of a challenge, and we need to make sure we get those resources out there. So we're working with volunteer organizations, and the broadcasters and the cable companies are doing the same, but I'm concerned that it may not be enough.
As the transition takes hold, each channel will receive additional channels. There are concerns among minority and women-owned media and new media companies who are losing out on a plethora of new channels that are going to come online. What's your response?
Well, we've really seen massive media consolidation in this country where the handful of companies tend to dominate the vast bulk of what Americans see and hear over the broadcast media. This, in some ways, really accelerates that because one channel becomes five, and we have allowed companies now, over my objection, to buy both a newspaper and a broadcast outlet in the same community. That television outlet, all of a sudden, instead of being one channel, can become four or five channels. So one owner who owns two television channels, instead of having two, now has 8 to 10. So it seems that this is something that has the potential to actually accelerate media consolidation. There should be ways that we look at this to ensure that those broadcasters who get additional opportunities also give something back to their communities, that they serve the public interest, that we put special obligations on digital broadcasters. But to date, despite the fact that Vice President Gore in 1998 convened a commission that suggested that we put special public interest obligations on digital broadcasters, 10 years later, it hasn't been done. And I'm very concerned about it. I think there's more that we need to do to make sure that those broadcasters ensure that all of the needs of the community are met, that minorities and all the different members of the community in which they serve have access to those airwaves.
That was FSRN's Leanne Caldwell speaking with FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein. Adelstein will be appearing at public hearings on digital TV tonight in Oakland, California, and tomorrow in San Francisco. Several national banks across the country require thumbprints from customers before providing services. While some banks claim that this prevents fraud, public interest advocates criticize the policy as a way of criminalizing the poor. They also suggest that thumbprinting is a way of discouraging non-account holders from using the bank. From New York City, Zoe Sullivan takes a look at Chase Bank, which requires two forms of ID and a thumbprint before they'll cash a check.
Chase Bank recently implemented a policy in its New York branches requiring two forms of ID and a thumbprint from any non-Chase customer cashing a Chase check. This policy was already in place in other regions where Chase operates. Jose Aguirre works for a company that banks with Chase.
I have been cashing my check for 4 years with the same brand. They know me. But even they know me, they ask me for two IDs and for my fingerprint every time I'm going to cash my check.
Banks in the Southwest first began practicing fingerprinting in the mid-1990s. Chase is not the only bank with this policy. Some others include M&T, First Union, and U.S. Bancorp. Critics of the policy say it disproportionately affects low-income people, many of whom are less likely to have checking and savings accounts. According to the Tennessee Fair Housing Council, poor households are less likely to have checking and savings accounts for two reasons. Low-income consumers have less money to keep in the bank, and the fees charged make small accounts impractical. Critics of thumbprinting also cite privacy as a concern. Once a bank has a database of thumbprints, the information could be shared with immigration and other authorities. De Del Rio is Associate Director at New York's Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project, or NEDAP, a financial justice resource center. Del Rio spoke to FSRN outside her Manhattan office.
When you're a bank that's focused on serving low-income people or immigrants, you know, to require that population to provide fingerprints, you know, it's sort of you're treating people as criminals off the bat.
Tom Kelly, a spokesperson for Chase, defends its policy.
The idea is really we're trying to prevent fraud. If a check is issued by a customer, whether it's a company or an individual, and it's written to someone who is not a customer of our bank, they can go to their own bank and cash it, that's fine. But if they're cashing it us, we don't have a relationship with them. We don't know who they are. So we require them to provide two forms of identification and to actually do a thumbprint. And it's a deterrent to people who want to commit fraud.
But customer Jose Aguirre suggests another reason for the policy.
Every time I go over there, they push me again to open an account. They ask me again to open an account. I say, no. I close my account for this reason. I don't want to open an account. I don't need to open an account because I have other bank with better service close to my home, close to my office. But I need to cash my check in some place when I receive my paycheck.
Aguirre said that he needs cash for expenses like gas and groceries and that he can't wait for the time that it takes for the check to clear at his bank. Although Chase asserts that its policy is aimed at fraud prevention, Aguirre's experience raises the question of whether the policy is a way to gain customers or to avoid providing certain services. The bank does not require a thumbprint to open an account. Sarah Ludwig, founder and co-director of NEDAP, points out another issue. When people have a hard time cashing checks at banks, they often turn to check cashing stores, which charge high fees.
A lot of the banks actually capitalize, they finance the check cashers. And if I were somebody walking in with my paycheck and I had been getting it habitually cashed at the bank that my employer drew the check on, but I didn't have an account there, and, you know, I'd be pretty much driven to the local check cashier if I didn't want to give my thumbprint, because it's really a signal from the bank, we don't want to cash your checks here.
Ludwig also says that banks are making it harder for low-income people to use their services.
These are the same institutions that make a lot of noise about how important it is to bring the unbanked into the banking mainstream. That you're saying, you know, let's make sure that people have access to accounts, that they, you know, feel welcome in banks and so forth. But from thumbprinting people, which is very unwelcoming, to charging, you know, huge amounts of money for even small amounts overdrawn through bounce protection, and really just gouging fees as banks increasingly try to make their profits off of fees, that, you know, actually their rhetoric doesn't even come close to their actions and their practices.
Although advocates have been protesting the fingerprinting practice since it began in the 1990s, there is currently no legislation prohibiting it. Del Rio hopes that advocates and civil rights groups will be able to bring enough pressure to stop thumbprinting. For FSRN, this is Zoe Sullivan in New York.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.